We are breaking down all aspects of Yankee baseball. This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show with your host, Andrew Rotondi and Scott Reinen. Let's go.
What's going on, everyone? This is the Bronx Pinstripe Show, episode 77. It is Monday morning. I am slowly, and I'm not even sure I'm actually recovering from another bachelor party. Scott, I know it was your birthday yesterday, so we decided to do this Monday morning. I'm in pain, just straight up pain. How about you?
This is 2 weeks in a row that I've made you get up. While last time you said that it was like the crack of dawn, and maybe this was 2 weeks ago, crack of dawn, and it was 10 a.m. This literally was closer to the crack of dawn. This is a 7 a.m. recording. And yeah, I became even more of a crafty veteran yesterday by turning 36 years old. It's insane. I can't believe that that number is actually real. So yeah, I'm good.
You can relate to some of these guys on the Yankees that are in their late 30s breaking down their backs, their knees, their necks, all sorts of injuries.
No doubt.
You know their pain.
I can't even imagine playing baseball every day and trying to. I mean, I wake up and my wrist hurts for some reason. I don't know. Okay. I don't know why. I have no idea why.
70.
So happy 36th birthday. Your wrist hurts in the morning.
Yes. Awesome. So, okay, let's talk about your birthday. What did you do yesterday to celebrate the big 3-6?
Well, the big 3-6. I guess after 30, nothing really happens to me. I don't know. It's just not eventful. So it was relatively low-key. My wife and I hung out, and we did a lunch. We went out to dinner. We did a, you know, just very low-key things. And I got my favorite lunch, which was delicious. I had a BLT. It's a tuna BLT, which is phenomenal. This place that I go to they do like giant tuna steaks. It's like a huge fat tuna steak, and they put bacon, lettuce, tomato on it with this wasabi sauce. It's so good.
That does sound good.
Sweet potato fries. Can't beat it.
So that's what I have to look forward to when I turn 36. Just nice meals.
Yeah, just nice meals. There's just, I mean, you don't want to celebrate the birthdays anymore. I don't know. To me, it's just not like, it's just another day, you know? I guess 40, which is like crazy because I always think of my mother as 40. I don't think of me as 40. I have a very difficult time putting myself in like an older age bracket because I don't feel that way, you know?
Yeah.
I'm very immature.
I'm turning 28 in a couple weeks, and not that 28 is really a big deal, but yeah, at this point in my life, birthdays just are not important.
Yeah, 30 will be a big one for you because that's when you become an adult.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, that's exactly. Well, you have no choice at that point.
We'll see that.
You are an adult as deemed by society at 30.
I don't really feel like much of an adult. I just spent the weekend in Atlantic City on a bachelor party. I've come to the conclusion that Atlantic City is the single worst place on earth. I don't ever want to go back.
You know, I agree with you.
I know I will go back. I will undoubtedly go back, but I hate it.
Yeah, I heard MGM just bought what's the big hotel down there? The Brigada, the new one?
Yeah,
We
didn't even make it to the Borgata.
Oh, God, you went to the rest. You were slumming it.
We went to the slums. We just spent the entire two nights on the boardwalk.
Oh, that's brutal.
So the thing is, we rented a house. We rented an Airbnb because there was 9 of us. And it was actually a pretty decent house, but it was in a secluded area. It was about a 10-minute drive from the boardwalk and the Borgata, so we're kind of in the middle. And we just made the decision to go to the boardwalk each night since there were more options.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah, when I was there, I mean, I haven't been there in a long time, but the boardwalk was pretty shady at that point.
Yeah,
I mean, I can't imagine it getting much better.
It's not exactly. So you don't feel unsafe when you're on
the border. No, that's not what I mean. I felt completely safe. I mean, I was in my, when you're, I feel like from 25 to 28, you're invincible anyway. So you feel safe.
Yeah. Well, you walk two blocks off and you don't feel so safe.
Yeah.
I don't know how long ago you were there, but was the giant hotel, the Revel there? Is like a hotel casino?
I don't remember.
It has like, anyway, they built it of, I don't know, some number of years ago, not that long ago, but they had the genius idea to make it a family-friendly casino, so there's no smoking inside or anything like that, and it immediately went bankrupt.
Yeah, family-friendly in Atlantic City.
No one's bringing their 4-year-old to Atlantic City.
No.
Although I do see families, whenever I'm in Vegas, I do see families and I just scratch my head. Like, what the hell are you doing?
Well, Vegas is different. You can be family oriented if you're in Vegas. You just gotta have some blinders on occasionally, the kids. But
there's so many other places you could take your family other than Las Vegas.
But the Vegas is like a giant theme park. You know what I mean? Like, there's cool stuff.
Theme park.
Yeah, that's true. But there's also like cool stuff. There's shows, and I don't know. I could see that more than Atlantic City. Atlantic City is just like
trash.
You want to have a really, really just jacked up weekend? Go to Atlantic City.
Do you want to feel like you need a 5-hour shower after the weekend? Go to Atlantic City. So number 77. Shout out to our guy, Burnt Out Attorney, gave us another great list of stats. Let's do a few of them. We'll just run through these quickly. 1977 was the first World Series championship under the Boss, and that was the Bronx's burning year. So I don't know if you ever watched that ESPN miniseries, but that I thought that was a very good show, and I actually would like to go back and watch that at some point.
Yeah, I've seen it. I want to go back and watch it again. I feel like as we do this show and as we get more into, you know, the nitty gritty of all these teams, I'm becoming more of a historian. Or I feel like a lot of these things are coming back. And that was just before my time. And I was born in 80, so that was just before I was born. But yeah, it's awesome actually to look back at that era. I think it's very interesting. They definitely got a pretty awesome dynamic.
It was such a quick rise to success and then such a quick drop off in the late 70s there.
Yeah.
Also, number 77 is the career postseason singles for Bernie Williams. Second all time. I don't know who's first, but I would take a guess it's Derek Jeter.
Probably Bernie. I mean, the amount of games that those guys played in, you got to believe that they're all in the
full
on the top
seasons.
Of the list.
They played full seasons worth of games in the playoffs. It is insane. And the thing that makes me that is most impressive to me is that, you know, Bernie Williams, Derek Jeter, all of those guys put up as good, if not slightly better, numbers in the postseason as they did in the regular season. Which some people might say, oh, well, is that really being clutch? And to me, that is definitely being clutch because you're facing way better competition. There's so much more pressure. And if you're putting up consistent numbers in the playoffs like you would in a July 14th baseball game, that's clutch in my mind.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you're right. That's absolutely where the best competition is. It's the best of that year. You're getting the best pitching staff. I mean, a lot of these teams will shuffle their staff, you know, to make it as lethal as possible for a short series. So you're definitely getting the best of the best at that point. So yeah, I agree with you. I think it's clutch and impressive, no doubt.
Final number 77 is the career home run total for Johnny Damon in pinstripes. Quickly on Johnny Damon, would you consider that signing a success for the Yankees?
Yeah, I guess it was a success. I hated him for a long time. It took me a long time to actually accept Johnny Damon because I don't know. I had some serious hatred for that guy.
Understandably, I mean he shoved a dagger through the hearts of all Yankee fans in 2004. But yeah. You know why I appreciated Johnny Damon? The dude went out and played.
He did. He
got banged up, and he went out there and played as many games as he possibly could. And you got to tip your hat off to a guy like that because the Yankees, look at some of these guys now, Mark Teixeira, Jacoby Ellsbury, Brett Gardner. The littlest of bruises and nicks will keep them out of a game. Johnny Damon would run through a wall for the team.
Yeah, I mean, it's not murder.
What?
That's that Johnny Damon quote when he's talking about Alex Rodriguez.
Oh, right. I forgot.
It's not murder.
It's not like he murdered somebody. He just did a little steroids. Who cares?
Johnny Damon. Yeah, I'd say what got me even more around the corner from him was that how big of like a mimbo he is and like just the way he talks. I'm like, oh, I really can't hate this guy. He's just, you know,
he's just
there to play baseball.
He's got some screws loose upstairs.
He's just there to play baseball.
Yeah. No.
He doesn't care what team he's on or what uniform. He might not even realize what uniform
he's on. Is he even retired at this point?
I don't know. He's definitely making the tour. He's around quite a bit. I feel like I see him.
Yeah, he's at Old Timers Day and everything. Because I know he was trying to hang on for 3,000 hits.
Yeah. Yeah, he went to Tampa Bay for a little while. He was definitely floating around. But, I mean, like after post-career, I feel like I see his face quite a bit around Yankee-centric things.
So, some news over the weekend, and I saw this on my phone as I was drunk on the Atlantic City boardwalk, but the greatest of all time, Muhammad Ali, died.
Yeah, that's a sad day to you know, we all know obviously that Ali was not doing well for an extended period of time, and he's been battling Parkinson's for honestly as long as I can remember. And you know, I never saw him fight. He was, I mean, obviously I've seen tape and I've seen, you know, movies and all sorts of documentaries and things like that. But I didn't live in that moment. But you know, he was so much bigger than a boxer. The amount of things that he did for civil rights and just kind of talked about social issues, and the guy was really larger than life. And I always respected that about him. And I always thought he was one of the most interesting people that ever lived.
Can I make a confession?
Yeah, go ahead.
I thought he was already dead.
Are you serious?
Yes. I did not know he was alive. Like, if you had asked me the day before he died, is Muhammad Ali dead or alive? I would have said dead. Like, I thought he died when that Will Smith movie came out.
Oh, no. That's bad. He lit the torch at the Olympics.
Yeah. I'm oblivious to a lot of things.
Yes, that's apparent. He was very nice. He was fighting. He was making public appearances while in a wheelchair, just completely, you know, taken over by Parkinson's.
Maybe that's why I didn't know it was Muhammad Ali.
He put himself out there. I mean, when most people would not put themselves in the public light, Ali put himself kind of in that spotlight and just embraced it and said, "Look, this is me and this is how I am."
Well, how old was he?
I want to say 74. I think he was
pretty
70.
Good for a boxer who's probably had dozens and dozens of concussions in his life to make it to that age.
Yeah, I mean, he's never been shy about the fact that he believes that a lot of the, you know, the things that happened to him with the Parkinson's and the brain issues that was because of was of boxing. But he also embraced the fact that, you know, boxing got
him
to
the life he chose.
That's the life he chose. Yeah. So
I mean, honestly, I mention it. I mean, I was kind of, you know, joking, not joking. I honestly didn't know he was dead. I was just, you know, trying to make a joke there. But Ali is in the conversation for greatest athletes of all time and greatest trash talker of all time. So, I mean, it is a pretty big deal that he has passed away. So we definitely have to mention it.
I definitely think he is the greatest trash talker of all time. This guy took everything to another level.
Yeah, and it was in the 60s and early 70s when that sort of thing was, you know, not... That was just not done. It had never been seen before, the trash talking that he did.
He kind of started the way that boxers talk. You know, how they have their ringside rants before.
Yeah, they're a show. It's kind of like, I'm sure it also kind of morphed into wrestling to a certain point. Where
I think it's morphed into a lot of things. Yeah. You're seeing bat flips. You're seeing a lot of things. You're seeing celebrations. And Muhammad Ali was never hid from anything. And he never hid his opinion. He never hid his antics. He never hid anything. I mean, the guy was extremely flamboyant and out there, and he didn't apologize for it. So you got to appreciate that.
So the Yankees, I feel like it's just been a slow burn for a few weeks after they got back to 500. On a 6-game win streak. Since then, it has been a slow, slow decline. And a couple injuries to note. First of all, Teixeira going on the 15-day DL, torn knee cartilage. And it's not like the Yankees are going to miss his bat at all, because he's having the worst season of his career, has not snapped out of it. It is now 2+ months into the season, and he still sucks. So we can't say, oh, it's just a slow start for Teixeira this year. I just think he's struggling, and he has no signs of snapping out of it, and this knee issue is not going to help him at all.
Well, no, I mean, torn knee cartilage to me sounds like 15 DL going on season ending.
Yeah.
That there's no way. I don't see him coming back. I don't know. You know, if he tries to, if he's going to rehab, obviously, and make every effort to come back, because he needs to for his own sake. He needs to prove that he's still a major league quality baseball player, because right now he's not. He's not even he's a shell of himself. But yeah, it's unfortunate to see, you know, what's happened. But yeah, you can't say that we miss him. We miss the potential of his bat, no doubt. But he hasn't done anything all year. All year long, he has not done anything. So while it's unfortunate that he is injured, it's really not affecting the Yankees on the field at all right now.
It's not. And his bat was just becoming a drain in the order, because Girardi was penciling him into the middle of the order because he is a name, Mark Teixeira. He's going to bat third, fourth, or fifth. And he was hitting like a pitcher. So it was really killing the team. And I thought Mike posed a good question on the website. I believe he posted this yesterday. What is Teixeira's legacy in New York? Because, he sort of set the stage with, he comes over in 2009 on that big contract, immediately makes a huge impact. Gold Glove defense, MVP type numbers, Yankees win the World Series. And he had a few good seasons. I think he was pretty solid through 2012. Every year that he was on the field and producing, the Yankees made the playoffs, including last year. I know he was hurt at the end of the year, but he put up MVP type numbers through July, and the Yankees did make the playoffs. So all the years that he's out, the team has really struggled. Not saying that Teixeira is the one key to the Yankees' success, but he does play a big part. But it's either been the highest of highs or the lowest of lows for Teixeira with the Yankees. So what do you think his legacy is?
Well, like you said, I mean, I think a lot of people, when looking back at his career, his Yankee career, will say that 2009, because he came over and helped the Yankees win that 27th title, that it was all worth it. Like, everything after that was, you know, just part of the baseball card, but he got that championship. And, you know, while that's absolutely true, I think he was a big help. I mean, obviously, I think he hit, you know, 39, 40 home runs in 2009, had 120 some RBIs. The guy was a monster. And yes, the fact that every season so far that we've done this show, two seasons, you have, and I've agreed with you every time coming into it, is that Mark Teixeira is the X factor of this lineup, because he's a switch hitter, because he hits in the middle of the lineup, because he's got the thump, kind of all things revolve around him and maybe the next power guy. So when he is not going well, the rest of the order, the construction of the lineup, isn't effective, and it's not to what they need it to be. So he's a huge part of it. And when we look back at his legacy, I think the one thing we will remember, or the two things we will remember, 2009, him helping us get a World Series, and we will remember the injuries.
I absolutely agree with you that those are the two things that stand out for me. And I think it proves, because he was a close to 300 career hitter before he came to the Yankees. I don't know how he was doing that, but he just was. If you want to say that there's a lot more shifts now or whatever, so it's taken away base hits from him, fine. But the facts are that he is about a 250 to 260 hitter with the Yankees. But it didn't matter. Batting average did not matter. When he was hitting home runs, the offense was producing. Right. So for everyone complaining that he wasn't hitting 300 anymore, he wasn't punching singles down the third base line when the shift was on, I didn't want him to do that. I wanted him to hit doubles and home runs. And when he was doing that, the Yankees were scoring runs. And when he isn't doing that, the Yankees weren't scoring runs. So that is just a little more proof that batting average is kind of a misleading stat, especially for a power hitter like Teixeira.
I think that's where you have to you take the number of the batting average, and that's the one area where you can look at it as deceiving when you're talking about a power hitter. Because those guys have to drive in runs. If they're driving in the runs, if those RBIs are there, then you can, you know, you could justify their existence and their value. Whereas you get a guy who's not hitting the ball out of the park, that's when batting average, to me, becomes more of a relevant statistic. The guys who are setting up to get to that guy.
So Dustin Ackley is also season-ending surgery for him. So the Yankees had a 48-hour period where they lost both of their first basemen. And not that we're complaining about really Teixeira or Ackley, because neither guy was hitting. And Ackley, I use quotation marks when I say first baseman, because the dude looked lost at first base. But he is out for the season, and they ended up calling up Parmalee, and Ref Snyder has been playing first base as well. The guy that they're not having play first base is Nick Swisher, and we can get into that in a second. But the fact that they move Ref Snyder over there tells me a few things. One, they're finally realizing that his bat, it does have an impact in the lineup, and they want to fit it in however they can. And also that, you know what? We have to eventually see what Ref Snyder can give us, or else we're just going to totally waste this talent who is getting older day by day.
It's a miracle. It's a minor miracle, and it's a shame what had to happen for this guy to get some playing time. I mean, literally everybody had to go down in front of him. And not only did they have to go down in front of him, but they weren't, there was no like vertical path to first base for Ref Snyder. They had to shift him over and create him as a first baseman, because he's not a first baseman. But what is he? He's an athlete. How long have you been saying that he's an athlete and can play all over the field? For two freaking years. We've been saying this. This guy should have been in the lineup last year as the starting second baseman and sliding the bat that shall go unnamed into a utility role. I mean, this is a guy that can play pretty much anywhere. So far, I mean, we haven't seen anything bad from Ref Snyder at first base. He's been playing pretty well. I mean, he hasn't been, I guess, fully tested, but first ball at him when he was a first batter. Is a pretty hard ground ball first base right at him. So, you know, welcome to the show at first base, kid. He gloved it, stepped on first, and recorded the out. So, to me, he looks pretty good over there.
Hey, if they're going to put up with Dustin Ackley at first base, they can certainly put up with Ref Snyder because he can't be much worse than Ackley was. I heard Girardi on Francesa last week saying that, you know, Ref Snyder has expressed his desire to play anywhere they want him in the field. He does feel most confident at second base and right field because those are the two positions he has experience with. I don't think they're ever going to play him at third base. I think that he is a fish out of water at third base. But first base, at least it's on the right side of the diamond. He's used to the ball off the bat on that side. It's just a matter of sort of learning the mechanics of first base, which I think the guy can do. I think he's capable of that. And you know what? They even sort of shifted Castro over to shortstop for a game, that makeup game in Detroit, just to get Ref Snyder's bat in the lineup to put him at second base. So I think that what they're going to do is showcase his bat for the rest of the season, however they can. And you know what? Maybe they have a utility player on their hands. Maybe they get a team to notice his bat and trade for him in the offseason. But all I know is it's good news that Ref Snyder's bat is getting in the order every day.
Absolutely. And you were talking about him on Francesa. Francesa was going off on the fact that Ref Snyder has zero position. And you know, I know that Francesa is he's usually very in tune with the way that the Yankees front office is feeling. You know, he's got friends in the Yankees organization. He's a Yankee fan, and he talks a lot about that. But to me, it this is such a long time coming and so frustrating to see this guy get in the lineup only now because, you know, all they do is talk about his defense and his defense and his defense. It's not ready. It's not ready. It's not ready. Meanwhile, we have guys like Chase Headley who has his glove is fine, but he's making errors over there. He makes throwing errors.
He's not winning games for you. He's not winning games for you defensively, Chase Headley.
And if they're trying to talk about run prevention goes out the window when you have zero people, hitting the ball for average. Zero people getting on base. Like, yeah, to an extent, like you can't bank on run prevention to win you the 1-0, 2-0 games every night. You have to score runs. And Ref Snyder is a bat that's been sitting there waiting to get in for 2 years. This guy has been ready to play in the major leagues, and his bat has been ready, and they have not done it. So finally, now that we're almost at a point where we're talking about selling the team and doing all these things because we're just creating a big hole, he's now allowed to get in. And that's great, fine. I'm happy he's there. It's just unfortunate how long it took them to open their eyes and see the potential of this guy. It really is frustrating to me.
You mentioned that Francesa quote, how he was saying Ref Snyder has no position and no place on the Yankees. And why do people either love or hate Ref Snyder? How did he become such a polarizing figure?
I don't know, because we talked about this last year about how he must have pissed somebody off because he comes up there was a rumor it was Francesa actually, wasn't it? It came from
he
Francesa.
He said that he
had a bad attitude. He was,
yeah, bad attitude, a little cocky, and I think Francesa said that's one of the reasons why he didn't stay in the major leagues when he got called up the first time.
Right, and that came from somewhere. He didn't just make that up. Someone told him that. You know, there was a little birdie that came to Francesa
doesn't make that kind of stuff up. So he had some source. I don't know who that source was. But I even think fans either say, like us, who say, oh, Ref Snyder can hit. I'd like to see him play. Or they say, oh, no, he sucks defensively. He's a waste.
I'm not hearing very many fans talking about that. I think at this point, everybody just wants to see a bat in there.
And maybe it was more last year when the Steven Drew Ref Snyder things came up, where they were saying, Ref Snyder, you think Steven Drew is bad, wait till Ref Snyder gets in there. But
yeah. I don't know. I'll argue with that person and crush them. But the fact that Ref Snyder is now playing and didn't have a position. I don't know why that was happening. I think maybe that his confidence was misplaced for cockiness at some point. Maybe he wasn't, behind closed doors, you know, that confidence was being expressed a little bit differently than what we've seen. All I have seen with all the interviews, everything talked about, everything I've seen from this guy is a confidence in his ability, the willingness to play anywhere, the willingness to do anything for the team, and nothing but just, you know, hustle. Like, this guy runs out every ground ball. He's flying around the diamond.
He better do that kind of stuff. He better do that kind of stuff, because while we are praising his bat, he's not a superstar and he's not going to be a superstar.
Right.
So he needs to play his ass off. He needs to hustle for everything. And if he can do that, I think he can have a successful major league career.
Yeah. And he does. That's what we've seen. We've seen this guy do nothing but positive
and
things.
And wouldn't you rather, I'm not saying you, I'm just talking in general, in generality. Wouldn't you rather have a guy who came through our system, impacted, you know, play on the team, get a lot of at-bats, be the utility guy, than some scrub like Brendan Ryan or Steven Drew that they signed off the scrap heap? Like, wouldn't you, isn't that more enjoyable to watch?
There's no doubt about it, but I don't think that's what Cashman thinks. He never thinks that way, nor does Girardi. I don't think they really care that a guy is homegrown, and the fact that he's homegrown makes a big difference for the fans.
Right.
I think it really does.
It's just numbers to them. They're plugging something into a computer, and player A gives them this, and player B gives them this. It doesn't matter who the names are attached to those players.
While a lot of times that is good,
and I agree with that, you have to also use your eyes at some point.
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, I think what we've seen in the past and the reason why he's been blocked, a lot of it had to do with the fact that I think both of those guys, Cashman and Girardi, would prefer a vet with a solid glove over a young guy who can hit that's erratic in the field. For whatever reason, that's more to the side that they lean towards.
Yeah, I mean, they had some weird obsession with Brendan Ryan. 2 years of trying to fit Brendan Ryan into the Yankees.
Yeah, I think that's more Girardi saying, I need a glove late in games. That's what I think.
There's plenty of gloves out there late in games. And also,
You're preaching to the choir.
The glove only comes in handy late in games when you have a lead, and they haven't had many leads lately. They went to Toronto, and they needed to win that series, and they ended up getting their ass kicked, and they got swept. And this really set me down a weird path last week where I started to get really down on this team. And it was really the first two games of the series that pissed me off, because game one, Monday night, Nova pitched definitely well enough to win. I'm not going to say he pitched great, but he pitched well enough to win, and the Yankees got shut out until the ninth inning. It was deja vu all over again from the previous week at the stadium against the Blue Jays, where the starting pitching keeps you in a very good position to win the game. Six innings, I think Nova pitched six innings and either two or three runs, and the offense had like two hits, just totally devastating. And to a starting pitcher, that has to get at you, right? You can't just, at a certain point, you can say, yeah, I want to go out there and put up zeros, and my job is to put up zeros and let the offense do what they do. But at a certain point, you got to say, the offense is going up there and going down 1-2-3 in the blink of an eye. What am I doing out here? It's extremely discouraging.
Well, I can only imagine, too, for a starting pitcher, the mindset. I mean, you know that this consistently happens, that these guys don't put up numbers. So you absolutely have to be perfect. And a lot of pitchers will make mistakes because they're trying to be too perfect. They'll try to focus in on a location too much and leave a ball out over the plate and not focus on their mechanics as much. There's just a lot of things, I think, that could go through your mind of trying to be too perfect, knowing that if that run scores, you're screwed. And then that run, you know, whether it could be a single that would, you know, turn it into an RBI would be a home run because you're leaving the ball up in the plate. There's just so many things that can go through a pitcher's mindset, I think, when they're trying to be too perfect, and it's not a good thing. It doesn't make them relax, for sure. So it's definitely not a good thing. It can only have an adverse effect on a pitcher's mindset.
Then Tuesday, CC went out there, and for the second consecutive time against Toronto, a very tough lineup, shut them down. Six innings. He pitched six plus innings. He had given up one run. It was a 1-1 ball game in the seventh inning. And Joe brings him back out for the seventh, which I understood because he was only at 80 pitches. And he gives up a leadoff double. So immediately Joe brings him out. I disagreed with this in the sense that Joe either needs to, A, give Betances a clean inning, or let CC work through that jam. Because we've seen a few times now this season where Betances comes in with runners on base, and he's not quite the same guy.
No, I mean, that you go back to last year even. We saw that a lot too. When he has a clean inning, he's a lot more effective than when he comes in with runners on base. And you're right. I agree with you too. I think when you lose the first game of the series like that and you have a 1-1 game, you need to pull everything out and try to win that game. And I think at that point you bring Patantis out for a clean seventh. So yeah, I think, you know,
even but what Joe is probably thinking is my starter has been pitching great. And we're not winning the game, so I can't fire through BMC in a tie ball game.
When you're playing Toronto on the road and you've lost the first series or the first game of the series, I think you need to put your team in a position to win the game. And I think at that point the best thing to do, if I'm the manager, best thing to do at that point is to bring in my stud pitchers.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to argue with you either way. I would have agreed with both situations. I just disagreed with the bringing CC out for one batter and then immediately taking him out. I know it was a leadoff double, but he had been escaping. He's proven the ability to escape jams this year. So, you know,
we're going to get into more of that too when we talk about Sunday, because he did the exact same thing. He brought him back out to face, I think it was Chris Davis, is a lefty. He brought him out because of the lefty on lefty, and it didn't work out and he took him out. So this is happening again.
Well, in that game on Tuesday in Toronto, Betances ended up giving up a couple singles. And I think we saw one of the reasons why some people complain about Ref Snyder. He's fine catching the ball in the outfield. He does not have an outfielder's arm, though. But you can't blame that inning on Ref Snyder. I saw people on Twitter trying to blame that inning on Ref Snyder. Betances can't give up two consecutive singles.
Yeah, he definitely doesn't have a terrific arm out there. And he bounced the ball. It was not a good throw. I don't know. I don't know what to say about that. Betances has got to be better.
Well, another thing where you can question Girardi is the fact that he ended up pinch hitting Brett Gardner for Rob Ref Snyder after they're down, which, again, makes no sense considering how lame Gardner had been offensively. But if you're going to end up using Gardner, why not use him for defensive purposes in the seventh inning instead of offensive purposes in the eighth inning?
You know, at that point, I think because it's a 1-1 game, he's trying to keep Ref Snyder's bat in the lineup at that point.
But if he's that concerned with Ref Snyder's outfield ability.
I don't know that he is. I don't know that he's as concerned in his outfield ability, in all honesty. First of all, I think it was a bad throw in the first place. Like, I think he's got a better arm than what we saw in that throw. I think it was a bad throw. I think he rushed the throw and he bounced it. It was just not a good throw in the first place. So I'm not totally chalking up his terrible arm. Brett Gardner does not have a good arm. Ellsbury doesn't have a good arm. Like, I think Ref Snyder has a bit of arm as those guys. I think it was a bad throw. I think it got down on him and it was a bad throw. So I don't know what he was thinking there. Obviously defensive purposes at that point, later in the game, but we're down. I'd keep his bat in there. I agree. Girardi should have kept him in for offensive reasons. You know, he goes lefty righty. Girardi does it all the time. I'm still keeping Ref Snyder in.
Yeah, Gardner's looked lost at the plate. I know he had a good, I believe he had a good series in Baltimore, but at the point in Toronto, he was really struggling. He had struggled the whole month of May. But CC's last two games versus Toronto, he's pitched 13 innings and only given up two earned runs, and he got saddled with two losses.
That's terrible. Yeah, that's real bad. I mean, obviously we know what's going on there. There's zero people scoring runs. So big man's coming out there and pitching well and keeping the Yankees in the game, so I applaud him for that.
And they ended up getting swept. Tanaka could not be the stopper that they needed him to be on Wednesday. They ended up getting shut out, so it didn't matter. They lost 7-0, and that put their record at 2-6 since getting to 500, which is just sums up this team for this year. It's any step they take forward, they take two steps back. And when you finally reached 500, which was a milestone for this team, who had been 7 games under 500, they get back to 500 with a 6-game win streak. Everyone's starting to feel good about this season, and they immediately take a giant step back with a 2-6 record.
Yeah, it's like a Pineda outing, right? It's like, you know, the Yankees score 5 runs, and then he goes in and gives up 6 runs. It's frustrating to see. There needs to be some kind of a sustained success in order for the season to turn around, and they haven't shown that they can do it.
Well, to me, that showed that the success that they had in May was kind of a mirage. It was fake.
Right.
Because a team, after getting back to 500, should feel like they're sort of starting anew and we have a fresh start. We're right in this race. Let's start playing some baseball, and they couldn't do that.
And what's happening, which is completely baffling, is that this team is hitting their hot and cold streaks at the exact same time. Like everybody on the team, it seems like when they're struggling is struggling, and they're all in like a team wide slump. And when you have an entire lineup that's completely anemic like that, you're not going to win games, and you're gonna go through losing streaks. It's just it's crazy to me how this team, it's like they're all in the same cycle. It's like we're all gonna do well.
Their cycles have synced up.
Yeah, it's crazy.
They're all menstruating at the same time.
Exact same time. So everything when things are going well, everybody's doing well. When things are bad, everything's bad. So it's a crazy dynamic to me. And I've never seen it happen with a baseball team as far as like their offensive abilities and everybody kind of on the same page at the same time. So
hitting is contagious, and I guess slumping is also contagious. It's more contagious.
Yeah.
Thursday, they went to Detroit. Pineda was pitching. You and I talked last week about this being a huge game for Pineda, because if he goes out and gets crushed again, they're going to have to probably send him down to the minors.
Do something, yeah.
And, hey, maybe a little pressure actually finally, you know, made him pitch well, because he did pitch well against Detroit. So I guess Pineda is in the starting rotation for the foreseeable future, thanks to that one good outing in Detroit.
Well, and the funny thing is, before that outing, when Girardi was talking about the rotation and talking specifically about Pineda, I mean, he was basically saying that he had no plans of taking him out of the starting rotation at
that
point. Thank
you for bringing that up.
Yeah, because, I mean, to me, you're looking at that quote and you're looking at, like, you know, I don't know why I would make a change. It was something that was just completely baffling to hear.
He used the word silly. It would be silly to make a change at this point.
That's
silly
right.
to make a change on a guy with a 7 ERA, which is the worst in the American League. Yeah, why would I think about taking him out of the rotation?
Yeah, a guy just who like, had a plus, why would I think about, plus 11 ERA in the first two innings.
Why would I think about benching Chase Headley, who has zero extra base hits through 90 at-bats in the season? That's silly. That's a silly question to ask.
So that's another thing to even go down. I mean, the fact that it's not a consideration to bench a guy who's got the worst ERA among all qualified pitchers, and you know, some sporting a 11 plus ERA in the first two innings of a starting pitcher. I mean, that's the fact that your manager is not thinking about benching you at that point or making a move is puzzling. So anyway, it didn't matter, because he came out, pitched very well. To Pineda's credit, he was good against a very difficult lineup. Obviously, Detroit has an extremely good lineup. He pitched well. And the guys who normally are the reliable ones are the ones that, you know, kind of made our blood pressure go up a little bit at the end of the game.
This was a heart attack win. BMC, Betances gave up a run in his inning. Miller gave up a run in his inning. And then Chapman loads the bases with no outs. At this point, I believe it was, a 5-3 ball game? And there was a shot up the middle to Didi, who had come in. Ref Snyder had started at second base, so they moved Castro back over to second, Didi to short. And there was a pretty good shot up the middle. Didi gloves it, flips to Castro with the glove. Kind of off-balance throw, or off-balance catching the ball with his bare hand.
Bare hand, yeah.
Blows a bubble. Throws a strike to Teixeira, which really turned the inning around. It was a double play. They did get a run, but didn't. It really won the game for the Yankees. Unbelievably athletic play by the two guys up the middle. Which, say what you want about this team, if you think they can make the playoffs or not make the playoffs, at least we have Didi and Castro to look forward to for the next few years.
Yeah, it was impressive. I mean, on both ends, seeing Didi just getting to that ball with the flip, and then Castro, that was an athletic move to catch that ball. Like you said, he was falling back, like, off balance. He had to reach back to get the ball. And then I don't even know how he makes that throw. I mean, like, I don't know how the momentum of his body, it almost slingshotted him when he like reached back. It was impressive. And he did throw a strike. So it was an impressive double play, and a huge time, too. Huge time.
Kind of foreshadowed what was to come in Baltimore, though, with the bullpen struggling like that. Like you said, everyone's going into everyone's cycles are syncing up. It seems like Betances is starting to struggle a little bit, and Miller's like, I guess I'll struggle. And Chapman's like, yeah, I might as well give up a few hits while we're at it.
Might as well do it all at the same time. Let's just compound this issue, make it really bad for everybody to watch. Yeah, they were struggling. Betances, I mean, started struggling early in the week, and we're seeing these guys that were, you know, completely clean start giving up runs and Chapman starting to look like a mortal.
So, to, you know, complete honesty, Friday, Saturday, Sunday against Baltimore, I have no clue what happened. I was in a fog. So I know they lost 2 out of 3, which is the important thing. But it seems like Eovaldi, for the first time in about five, six starts, did not pitch well on Friday night.
Evaldi did not have his good stuff. It was very obvious that he didn't have his good stuff, and he was struggling through the game. But so I mean, look, it's been a month plus since this dude has really had a bad start. Eventually, it's going to happen. It happens to the best, unless your name is Jake Arrieta, then it doesn't happen for like a year, and then you have one bad outing. But Evaldi is a guy that kept the Yankees in the game. The Yankees still, at this point, are not hitting the ball well. I don't care that they scored some runs in this inning. I was so mad. I made a note in this game. It was the top of the fourth inning. And this was we were going against a Baltimore lineup a Baltimore pitcher, Chris Tillman, who was very good for the first, I want to say, three innings. And then I think in the fourth inning, he started walking guys. And his control was erratic, like out of the blue. Very good first three innings. Fourth inning, erratic. I'm going to go through a situation because this situation, I said last week that I don't get mad during the game. I got mad during this game, and nothing even happened. It was two runners on. I want to say they were walks. Tillman was very erratic. Headley's up with Tillman struggling, falls behind 2-0. Okay, so it's a 2-0 count to Headley. Pitching coach comes out to talk to Tillman. Tillman cannot throw strikes at this point. A mound visit comes out. What in your mind? Let's just put yourself in the Chase Headley situation, okay? You're a struggling batter. You got two runners on. Your team is struggling. You have a 2-0 count with a guy who's been struggling to throw strikes. Pitching coach comes out. What do you think he's going to throw? I don't know.
I would guess ballpark. He's going to throw a batting practice meatball down the middle of the plate.
He's going to throw a strike, right? He's going to do everything he possibly can, this major league pitcher, after walking two guys. Pitching coach comes out. Probably going to give you a fastball, probably somewhere over the plate because he's not going to give the best location, so it's going to be fat, most likely. That's what I'm looking for, at least on a 2-0 count. No, this is not what happens. Chase Headley just sits there with the bat on his shoulder, does absolutely nothing, and he gets a 90-mile-an-hour fastball, teed up, 90 miles an hour. I don't know what better speed you can get. Down the center of the plate. Looks at it, ball goes down, and then Chase Headley promptly strikes out in the at-bat, leaving those two guys there.
Well, can I play devil's advocate?
Hold on. This, to me, is the most frustrating type of situation because there is an opportunity right now to strike. There's an opportunity with a team that's struggling to score runs over the whole season. When you have a hitter's count, you know damn well that this guy is either going to throw a meatball down the middle or it's going to be just something that's probably well off the plate. So why not look fastball down the middle? If you get it, you swing at it. You'd be ready to pounce on this ball because that's what a real a good hitter would have done. And a good hitter right then would have.
Chase Headley's not a good hitter. If he had swung at that ball.
If you're in the major leagues at that point, if you're in the major leagues, you know damn well that you can hit a 2-0 fastball coming down the middle with a guy struggling. If you look for it at least.
If he had swung at that ball, it would have been a ground ball double play to second base. I don't want Chase Headley swinging in that situation.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Chase Headley's best chance to get on base is to not swing the bat. He's either going to get walked or get hit by a pitch.
You can't have that situation. You, as a batter, you cannot have that mindset. You just can't.
It wouldn't surprise me if the take sign was on.
I doubt it. I seriously doubt it. I think that was all Chase Headley just being completely not confident in his abilities.
Well, he has no ability.
He does have ability. If you are a Major League Baseball player, you can hit a 90-mile-an-hour fastball down the middle. I don't care who you are.
If it's most other hitters, Yankee hitters in that situation, I want them swinging. I don't want – I'm being serious. I don't want Chase Headley swinging in that situation.
But that's ridiculous. You're completely discarding the fact that these guys have the talent to get to the Major League. You're discarding the fact that these guys
– But I've watched enough baseball this year to realize that Chase Headley sucks.
Even Chase Headley can hit a 90-mile-an-hour fastball when he knows it's coming. Anybody can do that. Double-A guys could do that.
Well, I mean, your point is that the team just is totally out of sync, and when they should be swinging the bat, they're not, and you know, they're grounded into double plays, and it's just the offense is totally, totally anemic, and everything is going wrong with them.
Basic baseball is failing on this team. The basic fundamentals, everything you learn of how to, you know, when you're supposed to hit, you know, when you're supposed to steal the bags, when you're supposed to take advantage of certain things, just game situations. It's the basics of the game of baseball that this team is making this even worse because they're struggling at that as well. And that's where I get frustrated. I get frustrated when the basics start happening. It's not if a guy grounds into a double play on a pitcher's count. You know, that to me happens. That stuff happens. But when you start making mental mistakes like this and not taking advantage of opportunities that are given to you, that's when I'm starting to get frustrated. That's when Joe Girardi needs to go freaking apeshit on this team.
Do you think he goes apeshit?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't. You see this guy get livid with umpires, right? You see when Girardi has a good umpire's rant, it's pretty good. Like the veins start popping out. Like it looks like he's going to have a volcanic explosion because things start getting really swelled up. I want him to do that on his team. Like can we show some emotion to the team? Can we get frustrated in the dugout and you know, maybe have a shouting match?
Well, we know
let emotions take over you at some point.
We know he doesn't do it publicly. He will back his players even when they have 7 ERAs and say that it's silly. Why would I take him out? That's a silly question. But who knows? Maybe he does get mad in the clubhouse when the doors are closed. I don't think so. But maybe he does. Saturday, what happened? So they were up 8-0, it seems, and the bullpen imploded in the 7th inning.
They were up 7-0. They were up 7-0. Nova was pitching very well. The bullpen imploded. Nova came out. Nova was very much done, and it was obvious that he was done. I was on Twitter talking about this game, and like where everybody's sitting there like, yep, he's done. The first two guys get on, I think he faced 5 guys. 2 guys got on. It was very obvious. He let up a couple runs. It was very obvious that he was done, and Girardi just kept him in the game. For some ongoing...
Well, it's a seven run lead, but you're right. Bring in some scrub.
Bring in somebody. He was done. It was very obvious that he was done. And to you know, as many times as we've been arguing about Joe Girardi taking guys out too early, he obviously was leaving Nova in too late. It was very clear to everybody watching that game that Nova was done for this game. And he just let him in, and yeah, they came back in the game. I mean, the Yankees scored an insurance run to put him up 8-6. But yeah, it was a game that Miller had to come in, Betances had to come in. Chapman. It was a game that should have been a mop up game, and it wasn't.
And it's games like that where the starter, maybe thanks to some poor management, and then the 4, 5, 6 guys in the bullpen who can't close out a double, or you know, a big lead, a 6-7 run lead. It's reasons like that why you see the bullpen struggling in stretches, because the Yankees only win ball games when BMC pitches. So on Sunday, when Betances comes in, who had been struggling, he gives up runs. And in, you know, the 7th inning, he escaped a jam. And then the 8th inning, he gives up, I believe it was 1st and 2nd, and then the rain delay happened. So you knew he wasn't coming back out after that. You knew it was going to be Chapman.
He was getting pulled at that point anyway. There was a pitching change happening.
Okay, so I was following on
Chapman was coming in. Yeah,
I was following on my phone. So, you know, I'm kind of going off game, you know, game cast what happened here. But... You knew it was going to be Chapman who was going to need to get a 5-out save, and he just couldn't get it done.
Yeah, it was, the writing was starting to be on the wall at that point when the Orioles got the 2 runs on, and the rain delay came at a strange time because Chapman was about to come in the game. They it just didn't happen because the rain started happening right at that point, and then he came in. Once the delay, I don't know how long that delay was. It was probably an hour. I mean, it was a significant delay. So it's going to throw a guy off, right? The guy's warmed up, then he's got to go back, warm up again. Definitely throws him off of his normal routine, but struggled. I mean, Wieters had a huge hit and hit it was 100 and some mile an hour fastball that he just smacked up the middle that Ellsbury threw home, took a weird hop, hopped over McCann. I thought McCann should have caught the ball. There was an error on Ellsbury, kind of a strange error, but let up 3 runs, and it was game over at that point.
So...
Real quick, I forgot to mention on Saturday, Nova, when he took Nova out, Goody did come in and got lit up. I mean, so it compounded the issue. I mean,
right.
Goody did not do anything well either, and that's when you had to see Miller and Chapman come in.
The Nick Goodies of the world need to step up in that situation and make it so you don't have to use Miller.
No doubt.
But do you think with Betances it's overuse, or is this just a bad stretch, or what's going on here with him?
I don't know, because we see bad stretches from him. I mean, it's,
yeah,
we see him struggle. He's not, when he's on fire, when he's on, he's probably one of the toughest, if not the toughest, right-handed reliever in the game. And when he's when he's struggling, and I don't know if he's – I mean, there were rumors early on when he struggled in Boston that he was tipping pitches, and I don't know if he's still doing that, if that's come back, or if he's just – you know, if it's him in the stretch that he's struggling and as the season
well, he's always
goes
in the
on.
Stretch.
Well, that's true, but when runners on base is what I meant. Mm-hmm. When runners are on base, that just becomes more of an issue. I don't know. I don't know if it's a mechanics thing, but it's interesting. It's weird to see that he struggles in these long stretches. It seems like a week at a time he struggles.
I would guess that he's probably not locating his fastball because that's what tends to happen when Betances struggles. I think his best pitch is his knuckle curve. That's his out pitch, and I think he can throw it for strikes anytime he wants. But his fastball does become erratic at some points. He needs to at least locate it near the bottom of the strike zone, outside corner to righties if he's going to be successful. And sometimes he gets very wild with it. So it's only knuckle curve or fastball down the middle. And it's tough to pitch like that.
Well, and I saw the last when he was pitching, they threw up the stat about the amount of times that he uses those pitches. And it was to a 65% swing that he's using the curve.
So he kind of pitches backwards.
That's his go-to safe pitch, I think. Yeah, he does pitch backwards. So these guys got to look out for that, plus 90, 98 plus mile an hour fastball.
But if they know it's going to be nowhere near the plate, then they don't have to worry about it.
You're right. And he will spin that occasional breaking ball in the center of the plate. So, and we've seen that a couple times go out of the park. I think David Ortiz hit a curve out of the park a very long ways.
Yeah, a few times.
Yeah.
So Yankees lost the series in Baltimore. They finally head home. They're in this gauntlet of a schedule where they have no off days until June 12th or June 13th. They have four versus Anaheim and then three versus Detroit. I mean, we're at a point where if it needs to turn around ASAP or else we don't have a baseball season.
There's no doubt. We were talking about CeCe earlier, and when you're getting good starts out of your number five, I mean, he's not even the number five guy anymore, but when you're getting good starts out of CeCe Sabathia, those are the games that you need to win a good amount of them. And when you're getting good starts, that's gravy, right? And you need to, you're probably going against another number four, number five guy. You got to win those games. And when your number five starter is pitching well, and CeCe on Sunday, you know, we were talking about CeCe about how Girardi pulled him out of the game early on Monday, was it? And then Sunday he did a similar thing. This was a different situation when CeCe Sabathia kept us in this game. It was 1-1. He had five walks up until that point. Joe brings him back out to face, I think it was Chris Davis. It was a lefty matchup. Walks him. Sixth walk of the game. Like, to me, we should have lost that game anyway because CeCe just somehow got out of a lot of these jams. I mean, he was getting key double plays at times. But when you walk five guys, I mean, you shouldn't win the ball game if your starting pitcher wins that many, walks that many guys. But again, he brought him out knowing that he didn't have his best control, brought him back out, walked another guy, and I think he was over 100 pitches at that point too, which makes no sense. I mean, where's the binder on CeCe if you're pulling him at 80 pitches after a leadoff walk when you're bringing him back out for a clean inning to face a lefty at 100 pitches? I don't understand. There's no rhyme or reason for that. Maybe there's zero confidence for a lefty coming out to face Chris Davis at that point, but I don't know. He's been through the rotation. Give him another look. So I don't know. It's a very frustrating – Girardi was a very frustrating manager this week, and the players did not back him up. But, yeah, you got to win those games. You got to win those games. And when you're going against Anaheim with Mike Trout coming in and then three against Detroit – These are going to be tough games. Detroit's fighting for their life in the Central. That's a tough division right now. And Anaheim's trying to get back into something, you know, to make themselves relevant again. So these aren't going to be these are not going to be easy games. These are going to be very tough games, and we'll see.
So let's get into some mailbags here. What do we got first?
First is from Cody Graham. He's at CodyGraham12 on Twitter. He says, "Hey guys, first I want to say I love the podcast. Thanks, Cody. Appreciate that. My question revolves around Brian McCann and Carlos Beltran. To jumpstart the season, slash the rebuild, would it make sense to have McCann play first base and bring up Gary Sanchez? Similarly, wouldn't it make sense at this point to have Beltran as the primary DH and have Hicks play every day? This team is too old, breaking down, and I'd love to see them start the youth movement sooner than later."
I don't know if you saw, but I did write a sort of plan for the Yankees on Friday, and I think that they should start to think about rebuilding, because you need to be realistic about this team and where they're going. And while we have seen the pitching steadily improve this season, the offense has not seemed to improve. And I don't think this is a playoff caliber offense. So I'm not saying that the season is definitely over at this point, because it is June. But Yankees ownership and Brian Cashman need to start thinking that if this team is still, you know, 3, 4, 5 games under 500 come July, they definitely need to sell, because you can't hang on for dear life only to have them miss the playoffs by 5, 6 games. They need to start thinking about the future, because this team does have a future. So, you know, some guys that I said they should consider trading, obviously Carlos Beltran, Brett Gardner, are two guys that I think that they could trade, because, you know, the Royals and the Indians are two teams that both need outfield help, and those guys could definitely help them. So, you know, Cody mentions McCann going over to first base. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a possibility, with the fact, especially now that Teixeira and Ackley are out.
I think if everything was going well right now, and besides the injuries at first base, I think we would see McCann over there a lot more often. The unfortunate situation right now is that Gary Sanchez is hurt. So
yeah, it's the thumb issue.
It's really not it's not a viable option at this point, because one, Romine, you know, hurt himself with that the pregame warm up with Chapman. So we're very stretched very thin at catcher right now. So McCann's got to kind of be the iron guy behind the plate at this point right now in the season. He's just got to be that guy. But if Sanchez can come back and prove that he's healthy and hitting at AAA, you know, maybe even for like some, you know, a quote unquote rehab stint at AAA, I would bring him up pretty soon after that, because he's definitely needed on this team. And I would definitely move McCann, not to the primary first base spot, but definitely have him, you know, going over there, you know, a couple times a week.
I also wrote that the Yankees should not consider trading Brian McCann, because he can have that first base versatility that does come in handy when there are injuries, or next season if Greg Bird is struggling a little bit and, you know, you need more of a veteran bat or veteran presence over there. McCann could help out that way, because I think this is Teixeira's last season with the Yankees, especially now with all these injuries.
Well, if you look at McCann also, I mean, McCann's a guy who can provide some power in the middle of that lineup, and we're going to need that power next year. There's no doubt about it. We're going to need that thump. And if we could give him some days off of catching and playing first base, I think that will only help his legs, help his pop going to the short porch. I think it'll give him a little bit more energy to provide some more power in the middle of that lineup, because I think we're going to need it. And so I agree with you. I think he's actually he could be a valuable piece next year because of his flexibility in the field, and the fact that Bird's coming off of an injury, you know, just to throw him into the gauntlet and give him a full season at first base. Well, I think he can handle it. I think it's a lot to ask from a guy that young, and having the flexibility of a McCann over there to kind of pivot between the two young guys, Gary Sanchez and Greg Bird, first and catcher, I think is a very good option. Plus, I think he's a good leader in the clubhouse.
Cody mentions, do they move Beltran to the DH role? I don't see what that provides the Yankees. I mean, A-Rod is going to be the DH, assuming he's on the field. And Beltran has some trade value. So I would rather them trade Beltran than move him to a DH role in the second half of the season.
Yeah, and you mentioned the Kansas City Royals as a team that could potentially be looking at that. And I'm looking right at the Kansas City Royals, because you think about what they've done in the past and how they've kind of gotten over the hump in the second half of the past 2 years with trades. And they've done a very good job with kind of, you know, bringing in the Ben Zobras to kind of put their offense over the hump, or, you know, bringing in the Johnny Cueto's to put their starting pitching over the hump. I think that Carlos Beltran is a very interesting situation for that. A guy who can DH, a guy who can play a little bit of outfield, provide some power. I mean, we've seen that his bat is still extremely lively. I mean, going back, if you look at the past 12 months, Beltran has been, you know, an extremely good batter, driving in runs.
One of their more consistent hitters.
Extremely consistent and still has pop. And to say that, and to look back at his career, knowing that he started his career in Kansas City, I think it would be a pretty good swan song and a pretty good, I think, that he could be a very big piece of that puzzle. And I think Kansas City would really rally behind a Carlos Beltran signing. So I think that's a very interesting place to look at, especially with Kansas City playing good baseball again and surging in the AL Central right now.
And the Indians also lost two outfielders thanks to PED suspension. So they're a couple outfielders short, and they're still in the race, definitely wild card race. A couple reports also surfaced that the Nationals and the Giants are both eyeing the Yankee bullpen arms, assuming if the Yankees do sell them. That I know the Nationals are interested in both Chapman and Miller, and the Giants are specifically interested in Andrew Miller. And I think Andrew Miller has the most trade value on this team of anybody because he's proven that he can close. He's proven to be a team-oriented guy, and he also has two more years on his contract, so you're not just trading for a rental. A couple years ago, the Red Sox got Eduardo Rodriguez, who is a young left-handed starting pitcher, for the rental Andrew Miller from Baltimore, and that was in division. Imagine what the Yankees could get in return for Andrew Miller now. That, you know, they could get a top prospect.
And there's no doubt, he wasn't a closer at that point either. He didn't show that he could be a lockdown ninth inning guy either. I mean, he's proven to be extremely valuable in that bullpen.
They could get a top 25 prospect in baseball for Andrew Miller.
I totally agree with that. So we're looking at that. The fact that the Giants are in an even year, are trying to make baseball history. They're playing very good baseball. A guy like that to put them over the top is interesting. So definitely check that out. And first of all, we have our feature columns every day of the every weekday, which have been doing very well. Been getting a lot of really good feedback. If you're reading Friday's columns, you know Andrew is mostly putting a column up every Friday. I pitch it for him a couple weeks back, but you're getting kind of a consistent message almost. I mean, even on that week when I was talking about that, I kind of spoke to your sentiments this past week about how there's an opportunity, even in a down year, there's an opportunity for this team to do well for the future. And, you know, I truly believe that. I think that this is not a lost year, but if it comes down to it and we are at a point, I think the Yankees need to be opportunistic and need to take advantage of what is in front of them. And like you said, we have assets. While this team is struggling, there are proven assets on this team that can help out. There can help out a team probably in the National League or at least out of the AL East that is in contention and is trying to win a World Series. So you're looking at two very interesting teams, the Royals trying to make the World Series 3 years in a row, and the Giants trying to get back and win a World Series again in an even year. Two very interesting situations that would be baseball history on both accounts, that these guys may overpay for one of those, one or two of those guys on our
team. I just don't want Cashman and Yankees management to have false hope. Don't be afraid of selling this team. It's not like the stadium is 50,000 people every night. If they're not in it in the second half, people aren't going to show up regardless. They're going to show up for the ceremonies and you know, the Mariano Rivera day and the day that we're there when they're honoring the 96 team. That's obvious. But if this team's out of it, who wants to go watch Chase Headley and Carlos Beltran and Jacoby Ellsbury and Mark Teixeira struggle in the order? Wouldn't you rather watch some young guys? Yes. Trade whoever you can, get some prospects back, and let's go at this thing in 2017, because this team is not 5 years away. They're close. They have a lot of guys who hopefully are going to make an impact on this team soon.
And that's, you said hopefully. We need to see that too, right? So we could use this opportunity this season as an opportunity to kind of showcase some of these guys or give them some experience. I think it's a good opportunity for the Yankees to turn some of these guys into assets, into younger players, get younger while we're building towards the future. And I think it could be a big year. I know we've never seen this before, or at least in a long time. It hasn't happened in a very long time. So people are very apprehensive and just, but when you start looking at Twitter and you start looking at comments on the website and things like that, it's becoming very obvious that Yankee fans are okay with selling these teams off and getting younger and kind of, you know, getting the rest of the season to just get better. I think people are going to be okay with that.
At least the smart Yankee fans are.
Yeah.
Next one's from Owen Casey. He says, "Hi guys, I heard what you said about Michael Pineda, that he is in a Matt Harvey situation and doesn't have any confidence. The only thing is that Matt Harvey can win and is a proven elite pitcher. And when Harvey is on a roll, he's arguably the best pitcher in baseball. Pineda is the exact opposite." So the reason I mentioned this mailback is because I just want to clarify what I think you and I were saying about Michael Pineda and Matt Harvey.
I don't even remember talking about this.
This was last week. And
yeah, I must have blacked out when we talked about this, because I don't even remember it.
What I was saying is that the Yankees and Mets were in a similar situation with these guys, and that they had both struggled the entire season, and their next starts were very important for these guys. Right. Matt Harvey went out and pitched very well. I believe it was against the White Sox. And there was real talk that the Mets were going to either have to DL him or send him down to the minors or do something with Matt Harvey because he can't keep going out there getting crushed. The Yankees had the same situation with Michael Pineda. I still think they would be well-served sending him down. I don't think it's going to happen, but the conversation at least needed to be had between management, coaching, and Michael Pineda, because there needs to be expectations set with these guys that you can't just go out there and suck. You need to perform or else you don't have a guaranteed spot on this team. Michael Pineda has not done enough for the Yankees to have a guaranteed spot ever in this rotation.
And so the comparison between Harvey and Pineda wasn't a comparison between Harvey the pitcher, Pineda the pitcher. It was about the situation and their next start.
Yeah.
So to make that very clear, I agree. I think to Owen's point, Matt Harvey is a completely different mental makeup than Michael Pineda. Like, those guys are not even remotely on the same level of emotions. And to me, Matt Harvey, he looks like a different mindset when he's out there than Pineda, who's throwing up his hands. I wish Pineda had the competitiveness that Harvey has, because honestly, I like that part of him. He's kind of a dick. He looks like a dick. He is always talking about Qualcomm when he's on the Dan Patrick show, which I thought was hysterical. But he's definitely got like he feels like a top line starter, at least his mental makeup does. I wish Pineda would become more of a lockdown killer, because I think he's got the stuff to do it. I think he's got every bit of the stuff.
I'm just here so I don't get fined.
Yeah.
All right, so that's it for the mailbags this week. I believe, though, we do have one or two voicemail rants that we want to close out the show with. But before we get to that, just wanted to mention that I will not be on next week's show. I am traveling out of the country, so you do have a guest lined up. So definitely look forward to that. And Scott, any last words before we get out of here?
Yeah, just on this rant. So last week I had put on Twitter that best voicemail rant gets a T-shirt. So check out this voicemail rant. It was pretty good. We got a whole bunch of them that came in. I chose this one. So if you have sensitive ears, tune out now. But otherwise, you'll hear the frustration in the voice. So I appreciate it, and I will definitely be getting a T-shirt out next week. Andrew is going to be overseas. Sorry to see him go. Obviously, we're going to have Neil Keefe, who has also a podcast called Keefe to the City, who's going to be coming in and subbing in for the week. So looking forward to that as well. Have a great trip, Andrew. Be safe and come back to us.
And I'll try and leave a voicemail this time. Maybe I can get a Wi-Fi signal over there in Italy and I can leave you guys a voicemail. Because this is the only way I'm going to know what's going on with Yankees baseball is listening to this podcast.
Beautiful.
All right. We'll talk to you guys next time.
Yeah, you want a rant? Here's a rant. Do you hear that? That's the rest of the league laughing at what a joke this team has become. If you listen close enough, it's also the sound of Mr. George Steinbrenner rolling over on his grave. The problem I have is there's no accountability. It's due. No more excuses. A statement needs to be made. Because you want to give a 27-year contract to fucking Aspen, and you're afraid to hurt the feelings, you can't. Enough. You got guys that keep getting knocked out, you're pitching the balls off. They have to keep running the same team out there like it's going to change. That's the definition of the page. And this is not the Yankees way. There's still someone has the balls to make a change, nothing will. By the way, nice fucking catch tonight, Elsberry. Nice batting average, Brett. I should have been a Gardner. The shadow hasn't had a home run since Bush was in office. Call up Judge. Call up Swisher. Call up anyone who's hungry enough to give a shit. Matt Felt, S-T-M, Felt, 5. I'm sure.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Bronx Pinstripe Show. Make sure you find us on iTunes and subscribe so you can get all new episodes directly onto your phone. If you do like the show, we'd love for you to take a minute and give us a 5-star rating and review in iTunes. It really helps us out and allows us to create more shows. We're on Twitter at Bronx Pinstripes and the same on Facebook. You can always find us there talking Yankee baseball. Thanks again, guys, for your support. Really appreciate it, and go Yankees.